Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, and thanks to King and Wood Mellisons for providing this great function room this evening. It's great to have Andrew Constance back at the Sydney Institute. He was here not so long ago, and he's got obviously a very important portfolio, and we're delighted to have him back again. Now, the Minister is well known to you, so I will introduce him briefly. The Member for Bega. In government, he's held a number of important roles in ageing and disabilities, in finance, as Treasurer, and more recently as the Minister for Infrastructure and Transport. And Mr. Constance is going to speak to us tonight on the topic of, is good government enough? Andrew Constance, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Jared, and to Anne as well. Thank you for having me back again, and of course to Sydney Institute Chairman Nicholas Johnson, thank you as well. It's tremendous to be with you all. I'm sure you're all going to be focused on me and what I'm saying given that view, but we'll see how we go. But, look, I think there's a few things that everyone in this room can agree on. We want people in government who reform, who can kick the economy into gear, and of course get out of people's lives. But with the changes we're seeing in the body politic, is this enough? Does the average person want reform? Do they care about a budget that is in balance and a liberal approach to personal freedoms? Every man and his dog has an opinion on Trump, Brexit, and in our neck of the woods, Pauline Hanson. I believe politicians are ignorant if they think the rise of our generation's forgotten people won't influence the way we govern and the way we head into an electoral cycle at both state and national level in 2019. In 1942, Robert Menzies spoke about the forgotten people, taken for granted by each political party in turn, who make up, quote-unquote, the backbone of this great country. A generation later, another one of our country's legendary prime ministers, John Howard, became an election-winning machine, not least because of the support of those called Howard battlers. Like Menzies' forgotten people, these are ordinary mums and dads who work hard for everything they've got and who want their children to have a better life than they had. I mention these two junctures in our history not to say that we've seen it all before, because we haven't. Both Menzies and Howard harnessed the aspirations of the many and delivered a better nation for your average family. Both of these giants of politics recognised growing movements of people disaffected by the political process who could not see how governments were delivering for them. It is true that we are seeing this again, but instead of cleaving to a centre-right movement, this time the disaffected are walking away from major parties. It's worrying not just for my side of politics, but my friends in the Labor movement as well. It's no longer enough to manage the economy, deliver infrastructure and services, and tick all the boxes of what good government is. Our political representation and focus must be granular, more concerned with everyday lives of those who elect us. We need to focus on the issues house by house, street by street or village by village, if need be, and listen to the feedback. Listen to what people need fixed in their local areas. Respond when they say their school or hospital is run down. Don't kick it down the road when you see local infrastructure that needs to be upgraded, or those services that must be delivered. Good government means that building mega projects and local infrastructure concurrently should not be mutually exclusive. As a government, you are judged by how you manage major projects and, most importantly, how you deliver local infrastructure. While we should get granular with our politics to truly connect with people, we also shouldn't be afraid to lead and take risks. In state and federal systems, government intervention in people's lives needs to be scaled back. Coalition governments should stick to their guns and not fall into the trap of over-regulation and dictating to communities. And we saw this last year with the Greyhound industry decision. I consider myself lucky to be part of one of the best governments this state has ever seen. I can say that and mean it. But we need to get better at seeing whether people feel they are actually benefiting from the state's success. By any measure, New South Wales is the envy of the nation. We have an infrastructure program of some $73 billion, of which $41.5 billion has been dedicated to public transport and roads, and this expenditure is just in the next 4 years alone. We're a global sweet spot for infrastructure, and at the same time, investment in infrastructure, particularly from foreign interests. New South Wales transport cluster spending is more than that of every state and territory combined in the next 12 months. We're building mega projects like the Sydney Metro and WestConnex, the largest urban road and rail projects in the nation's history. We have other mega projects like NorthConnex, Sydney Light Rail, Parramatta Light Rail, Newcastle Light Rail. And only recently we opened the International Convention Centre, which will generate $5 billion for the economy alone. It's already open for business. Our economy's in the black, the best in the nation by far. But my worry is that people will see this as the new norm. This hasn't happened by accident. When we came to government, we made the conscious decision to recycle capital, to lease unproductive assets to the private sector and establish the infrastructure fund Restart New South Wales. And most importantly, we explained to people why we were doing this, what we would spend their money on, and how the investment would improve their lives. If you consider on average, people in this city spend more than 1 week of their lives in traffic each year, and we lose some $5 billion in lost economic activity as a result of this, little alone the enormous social cost, we have to tackle it. The price of congestion and our roads and transport infrastructure program is significant in this way to tackle this head on. We have to cut down on lost time, lost money, and lost productivity. Every time I'm home in Bega, this is not what people want to talk to me about in terms of infrastructure. Trump, Brexit, Hanson have all benefited from a political class that has spoken to itself for far too long. The so-called age of entitlement, where a select few members of Parliament or the community use and abuse their entitlements, is rightly shocking people, and it's playing right into the hands of parties like One Nation. And the thing that saddens me most about this, though, is that those who stand to lose from the rank opportunism of minor parties are the very people who believe they are their saviours. In country New South Wales, members of the community are those who stand to lose big if a party like Hanson's is ever able to form a coalition. The protectionism around stopping foreign investment and walking away from free trade agreements would devastate regional economies. You go and tell the oyster farmers on the far south coast that they can't sell their produce into Asia or into China. You go and tell them that this is off limits because of a cheap political decision. 10 years ago, these same farmers were selling oysters out of Hessian bags for $6 a dozen on the side of roads. Now they're flying overseas and their oysters are sold in five-star restaurants throughout Asia. In fact, one farmer who I think of quite fondly, Andy Baker, oyster farmer down on Pambula Lake, is now selling oysters into Tokyo restaurants at $13 an oyster. Anyone can play on the politics of prejudice. It's the easiest thing in the world to do. But the unintended consequences of this will put people out of work, take food off the family table and lead to families potentially losing their homes. You have parties genuinely wanting to whack up a wall and say no more foreign investment. And we saw that at the last state election with the debate around polls and wires and the ALP playing the card in relation to the Chinese. Why would we deny ourselves the opportunity to sell to the world by closing ourselves off from the world? It's simple to sell our products. We need buyers. When we came to government, we saw in this state not only a decade of severe underinvestment in infrastructure, but a lack of confidence from the business community and a lack of confidence from around the world. We need foreign investment and we need foreign interest. In the 16 years prior to the election of our government, our predecessors announced 12 transport projects and only delivered half a rail line. Business confidence was at rock bottom, particularly after public-private partnerships like the Cross City Tunnel and Laid Cove Tunnel, where projects such as these went into administration because the government was not willing to form a proper partnership, a true partnership. We came to government with a state more than $14 billion in debt, projected to rise to $20 billion. And we're now in a cash-positive position. And since then, we've also generated 320,000 new jobs. This is better than any other state and means families right across New South Wales have the dignity of work and the benefit of providing for their loved ones. What I mean to say is good government delivers tangible benefits. Benefits that a minor party or one exploiting fear or prejudice has no ability to deliver. So, does good government sell? Maybe it does. But the art is in the telling. People are sick of politicians who just tell them the economy is great. We're great. Everything's great. But can't explain how what we're doing will make their lives better. They're sick of governments who dictate instead of listen. They're sick and tired of being talked down to, told they live in the lucky country when the economy is going great guns and they should just be happy with what they can get. All politicians have to stop treating people like they're stupid, that their opinions are worthless and that it's their own fault if they can't see the fruit of the nation's success. In addition to changing the way we communicate to our communities, we need to think about the impact of our decisions. In New South Wales, maybe creating 100,000 jobs for the state is not as powerful as the loss of 50 jobs in Campbelltown. Or spending billions on hospitals may not be as appreciated as the $80,000 a year nurse in Cobar. In Western Sydney, at this point in time, there's more politics around what is happening to Parramatta Council's swimming pool than the building of a $300 million Western Sydney stadium. And if we don't get the strategy right on this, we stand to isolate the entire local community, those 180,000 people who venture to that pool every year. The importance of how we communicate to our communities is nowhere more clear than in rural and regional New South Wales. The recent by-election in Orange is a case in point. Now, objectively, despite the Greyhound decision, regional New South Wales is better off than it ever has been before. We're spending $8.8 billion on key infrastructure, ports, bridges, roads, airports, hospitals, and protecting our water security. Regional hospital upgrades, making up a whopping $2 billion in investment, including the fast-tracking of hospitals such as that at Lismore, a Health One facility in Corakai, and planning for hospitals in Taree, Maxville, Armidale and Grafton. Even Bega has a brand new regional hospital. It's the largest capital investment program in the region's history, in our state's history. And despite this, and a brilliant candidate in Orange, the community was under the impression we were governing for Sydney and that all our funding was funneled to Sydney projects. The environmental movement some time ago coined the phrase, think global, act local. Maybe it's time we just think local first. As Transport and Infrastructure Minister, it's my job to apply this to our massive building program and the way in which we communicate it. We are very deliberately focusing on the great things that are being achieved in local infrastructure for that reason. The appointment of former Australian Army Chief Lieutenant General Ken Gillespie today to drive delivery of infrastructure in regional New South Wales is another good step in this direction. He will be advising us on identifying any hold-ups, rolling out local infrastructure and fixing any problems, particularly with bureaucracy. He will ensure our regional projects are delivered as quickly as humanly possible by working closely with local communities, councils and industry groups. Technology also presents a great opportunity to think local first and apply the lessons on a wider scale. With our future transport roadmap, I want to see on-demand transport services right across this state. It's regional remote communities, regional communities here in Sydney, in particular, who will benefit from on-demand transport solutions tailored to them by locals, not dictated to by central government. It's about personalising the service delivery. Our point-to-point transport reform opened up the entire market, was an important step in changing transport to being about the customer first. A lot of people think that we just legalised Uber, amongst the first jurisdictions in the country to do so. But it's much bigger than Uber. We got rid of more than 50 taxi and hire car regulations that restricted the industry's ability to innovate. For example, we had this ridiculous situation where taxis were legally obliged to remain within 3 metres of their taxi at all times. They had to wait 15 minutes for a customer unless a different time was agreed. This is the type of prescriptive regulation that did nothing except increase costs for operators and tell them how to run their own businesses. Now, it wasn't an easy reform. It was a political minefield. But I learned a very important lesson in the process. Governments should not stick their head in the sand when smart technology emerges. We need to rise to the challenge, fix the legislative obstacles, and get out of the way. In the end, it's the customer who wins. I've said it many times, but transport is a technology business. We're turning transport planning on its head thanks to the data provided by Open. Thanks to this big data, which gives us a picture of our service that was never possible before, we're going to be able to better plan the services that need to be and how we deliver them. With congestion increasing and car ownership falling in some areas, particularly in the inner city, we can no longer think about transport planning the way we used to. As a state, we're undergoing unprecedented change in growth. This creates unique opportunities for us to apply new technologies and transform how we deliver road and public transport to our customers. As the city grows, the way we move around also needs to change. Take the transfer discount on Opal. This provides a financial incentive for switching modes of transport when you go from point A to point B. Already people are saving almost $800 a year and changing their travel choices because of this incentive. We want and need people to interchange. But at the moment, we don't have a real interconnected transport network. We have building blocks on building blocks, but no connectivity. Our projects are focused on filling in holes and missing links because we are playing catch-up to reach a properly interconnected network. The advent of autonomous vehicles is something I'm also really excited about, which has the potential to revolutionise transport all over New South Wales. I'm working closely with my colleague, Roads Minister Melinda Pavey, to have autonomous car trials up and running sooner rather than later. Having intelligent transport networks managed by data is vital to this working properly. Data volunteered by customers, demand aggregation platforms, autonomous vehicles and other sources will be combined with digitising our own networks to ensure transport is ready to support the next generation of intelligent vehicles and services. With Sydney Metro, the country's biggest public transport project, it's my job to reiterate until I'm blue in the face that the very real benefits this will have for everyone who relies on public transport to get to and from work. A fully automated train, a turn-up-and-go service, trains every 4 minutes in the peak with no need for a timetable, moving up to 46,000 passengers per hour compared to the existing network of 24,000, connecting northwest Sydney to southwest Sydney via the city. And one great thing for me as a Liberal, there's no train drivers and therefore no union members. There's our transport access program, which basically means if your station is old and run down and doesn't have a lift, we will upgrade it. There are more than 150 stations in New South Wales that are now accessible. And we've completed a total of 450 projects to improve the amenity and access to train stations. So far, more than 80% of passengers use stations which are fully accessible. But that's not much comfort if your station is not one of them. This in particular, whilst it has a significant investment behind it of some $890 million, is something that has a very real impact on how someone lives their life. And as a former Minister for Ageing and Disability Services, it's important to me that if you have limited mobility, you're not excluded from anything. That includes catching public transport. These are just some of the projects in my portfolio that are examples of where good government has been delivered in conjunction with explaining the benefits to communities. Where we've explained how we're taking the prosperity of this state and using it to better the lives of everybody. Minor parties may one day be able to win general elections, but will they be able to deliver a budget, build hospitals, roads and transport projects? And this is the key here. We need to recast the debate. What good is a politician who taps into fear if they can't deliver a single thing the community needs? Good government, in countering the anti-establishment political reaction in the longer term, can only be met by politicians willing to take risks, who are willing to put their own careers on the line to get the best outcome and best reform possible. But there is no point unless you bring people with you. This is what we did with the long-term lease of the state's electricity, distribution and transmission assets. The federal government, of course, should be taking risks for reforms the community would see tangible benefits from, in the same way my government walked the talk and leased the poles and wires. Taking this risk meant we were able to promise the unprecedented $20 billion in projects that are funded and being delivered right across New South Wales right now. And whilst we face ongoing attacks from our opponents, outright lies about network charges going up, people losing their jobs, and racist campaigns about China buying our assets, this was the right thing to do. The community in the end was convinced that the leasing of the distribution and transmission businesses was the right thing to do, unlocking that financial potential that is transforming the state right before our very eyes. We're seeing infrastructure promised for decades to communities, never delivered, which is now funded and being built. And it's why I'm urging Canberra to get on with major reform, get on with IR reform, get on with tax reform and federation reform to improve our national productivity. There is too much of the politics of survival, which is when minor parties can take hold, and too many politicians behaving in a way that fails the basic pub test. One Nation is set to poll 15 to 20% in the next couple of elections in some areas across Australia. And in a state like New South Wales under optional preferential voting, this means that a Member of Parliament at the next state election could be elected with a primary vote of between 30 and 35%. Unless we sell the benefits of good government, the ability to get results and improve lives while creating jobs and building infrastructure, everyone in our community can stand to win and win handsomely if we get it right. Not least those particularly from country areas. There's no doubt the effect of optional preferential voting in a state-based system means One Nation poses an enormous risk to the major political parties. Labor could lose votes in parts of Western Sydney, and in the regions it's my side of politics who can stand to lose quite significantly. And of course, when you're the incumbent, the very real risk of a One Nation vote is it will benefit your opponents. There's no doubt good government is something worth aspiring to, but its worth is measured only by the results you get for people at a local level. Thank you.
Well, many thanks to the Minister, and so we come to questions and discussion. I don't think we have a microphone today, so if I think your voice can't be heard, I'll repeat it. If I think it can't be understood, I'll make something up. We're all very helpful here. Thanks to King and Wood Mellisons for providing this farm facility. And so we get on to questions and discussion. That was an important talk across a number of areas, but just focusing on earlier on, you said that how important it was in the modern context for political politicians to speak to and hear the voice of the electorate in a considered and attentive manner. I hear the voice of the people occasionally, different sorts of people in different sorts of places, but early in the morning I tend to hear the voice of the people on ABC Radio Sydney with Wendy. I'm an old-fashioned socialist harmer. And if you listen to that voice, I don't think you'd ever do anything in government, because any kind of development seems to be opposed, like this, stadium development of Parramatta, which seems to be, to me, to be an important development. So to what extent do you listen? Because if there are some people who will never want any kind of change for whatever reason, and there are other people who have a very genuine complaint or something that should be attended to. So how do you work out to whom it's worth listening?
Great question. Can I just tell everyone I'm not clear felling the trees at Centennial Park for light rail, even though that has been promoted around the place. I think that the key point in all of this is that we are seeing pockets of activism against the infrastructure program. Some of it very legitimate if it's a landowner whose property is being acquired, versus groups who are obviously trying to make a political point. And you've got to weigh that up against the greater good. And there's no doubt, particularly when you are building significant and large motorways and very significant light rail projects, that there is this degree of intrusion. I'm a minister who's actually advertised construction disruption to the city to get the entire city to change its behaviour. And guess what? It worked. I can tell you it worked. I think there are parts of the city where that change has made an enormous difference. So it is very much a case of making sure that you do respond to those concerns. You outline your argument, because there are elements to an infrastructure build which can be intrusive. But at the end of the day, we have to unlock this enormous cost of congestion. This city has been unworkable for years. It's going to grow by another 2 million people in the next 25 years. So there is no choice. This work has to proceed. And to that end, we have to make sure that we're available, we have to communicate well, and we have to remind people of the bigger picture.
There's a question down the back, and then...
Minister, you are... Member for Bega, do you think your constituents understand the complexities of trying to balance the infrastructure development in the cities and trying to get it out to regional Australia as well? Do you think they understand it?
That's a great question. Everybody loses because of the congestion in our state capitals. It's a hard argument to mount to the people of Bega that the cost of congestion in Sydney is affecting their lives, but it is. The economic loss because of congestion statewide is expected to be $9 billion by 2020. Now, that affects the ability to invest, particularly from a government perspective, in infrastructure right across the board, let alone regional New South Wales. But what is happening in regional New South Wales at this point in time is also a major turnaround in terms of investment. There's a confidence there. Regional jobs growth in terms of New South Wales is on a par with states like Victoria under this government. It's difficult for me because I'll appear on Sydney's news every night, which is played out in country areas, and every time I get home I take the opportunity to go and stand next to a piece of infrastructure and remind people about that highway upgrade. And you know, we're getting on with some major mega projects in the bush. $500 million being spent to Broken Hill to provide them water security. Duplication of the Pacific Highway. Over $1 billion being spent on the Princess Highway. A regional hospital building program, some $2 billion, never ever seen before. But my question to you tonight, is that enough? Because in regional communities, there's still this sense of being isolated. And therein lies the challenge. For me to be re-elected at the next election, I've got to be across every little issue in every little town and be there representing people. And even if you don't win the fight, you're respected for taking it up. And therein lies the challenge. I walked around the country shows over the last couple of months at home, and I had lifelong Liberal supporters coming up to me and saying, I'm going to vote for One Nation next time. We like you, Andrew, but this is how we're going to place our vote. They were angry about the way in which entitlements were being abused in Canberra. That's what was tipping them over the edge. When I mounted the case, well, can One Nation really deliver you a hospital or a school or manage your budget? Those people then started to think about it a little bit differently. And that's something which, you know, I'm very mindful of. I took great delight during the last state election to have a dairy farmer's wife ring me, and she was angry, stirred up, said to me, I'm not voting for you because you're going to sell the poles and wires to China. I said to her, but your husband's selling his cheese to China. Three Bega cheese. And that's what's happening. So we've got to be very careful about this argument. It horrifies me. We want to be able to sell our produce and our minerals to the world, but we're going to mount this debate in this country which is about putting up walls. We've got to stop it. We've got to stop it now.
There's a question here.
Does the high-speed rail plan from Brisbane to Melbourne feature in your thinking at all?
I'm a big fan of it, having sat in the cockpit of the Shinkansen. Our biggest problem, I think, is our population is too small. If we're going to see high-speed rail invested in this country, it's got to be part of a development strategy. We've got to look at how value capture can be used to develop new cities and how we make those links. And if I was to look at high-speed rail, I'd look at it in the context of a Hume corridor strategy, to be honest, given the pressures that we're seeing in the Sydney Basin. There's no doubt, I think economically at this point in time, it doesn't stack up. But, you know, in due course, I'd be hopeful it does, unless we see a new technology come along in the meantime. There's a lot of talk in the States about the Hyperloop. Don't ask me how it works, but the US Secretary of Transport said to me, go and look at the Hyperloop. So if you get a chance tonight, get online and have a look at the Hyperloop. But, you know, there is, you know, absolutely a need for improved rail in this country. Now, we've just seen a 10% drop in the use of passenger rail on country trains in New South Wales. It's caused by a number of factors, but, you know, it's part of how you connect regional communities in particular. So I'm very passionate about high-speed rail. I'd love to see it. But unfortunately, I think our population's too small at this stage to fully support it.
I know it's theoretical. By a Hume corridor, you mean?
Well, we could look at how we might develop the Hume corridor in terms of another city, or potentially...
Or down the Hume Highway.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a question here, then we go over there.
Taking up that point about small populations in one in our outback, whatever, or our regional areas. I mean, when we had an agricultural-based major industry, we lived off the back of sheep or whatever, we had viable regional towns that drew people there because of work. What people are saying now is that one of our big problems is that the over-concentration of people in Australia to very few areas of highly industrialised activity, Sydney, Melbourne, maybe a bit of Brisbane, is what is causing this feeling that all the others are missing out. How can both national and state governments do more to work out where the big centres could be for people to have prosperous lives with less pressure on them having to live in the big cities, which have got housing problems and transport problems and all the other problems?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great point. I mean, you look at the issue around housing affordability, and everyone wants choices on where they live and how they live. There's no ifs or buts about that. But, I tend to agree we have enormous opportunities in regional New South Wales, particularly through some of our larger regional centres, where there is enormous growth. Wagga, well over 60,000 people now. The Dubbos, the Oranges, these types of centres, and of course the growth up and down the coastal strip. What's interesting for me is that I've got, for instance, communities, even in my own electorate, where communities don't have mobile phone reception, but they have NBN, which is interesting. There's nothing like visiting Nelligan in near Batemans Bay and getting back into range and having 20 messages on your phone. But to know that my parents-in-law have access to NBN, it's an extraordinary situation. So my sense out of it is that the opportunities in terms of regional areas are changing dramatically. I'm in the midst of deregulating air routes to drive even greater competition in terms of regional aviation. I want to see Canberra open up more slots at Kingsford Smith specifically for regional aviation. But at the same time, we're seeing people who are telecommuting, and we are seeing people who are doing extraordinary work living in the regions. Only 12 months ago, the head of the Department of Education and the head of the Office of Environment in New South Wales were local constituents of mine. And it wasn't uncommon to see them on a Rex plane on a Wednesday afternoon at 3 o'clock. So people are looking for that change in lifestyle, and there's a lot to be said for that. But again, it won't happen unless we invest in the infrastructure, invest in the construction jobs. And of course, I think also people are starting to look at what housing options there are outside of the metropolitan centre. We're starting to see that particularly in Newcastle, where our second largest city has been completely transformed. And there's a lot of investment interest. I know a lot of younger people are now looking to buy apartments up there because they see that as a different type of lifestyle to here in town.
So just on Newcastle, you sorted out the light rail opposition, did you? Just what happened there?
It was an interesting decision. The government took the deliberate decision to lift up the heavy rail and open up that whole precinct so the foreshore became part of the city again. And we've decided to build light rail down part of the corridor but then headed down Hunter Street. And anybody who's visited Newcastle recently will be blown away by the number of cranes in the sky, the residential development, the development of the university, who've also now purchased part of the corridor and are looking to develop more campuses in the heart of the city. It's an incredible transformation. I also took the decision to franchise not just light rail, but I put to market the entire transport network. It was the first in Australia. So we're now in the midst of franchising the ferry service, the buses, the light rail, the interchange, to get a truly integrated transport network for that city. And that will have an enormous effect. There's no doubt with the confidence that we're starting to see in Newcastle, particularly around the research capabilities of the university, an incredible transformation. It's one of the great achievements, I think, of this government. It all came about because, quite frankly, we had the guts to lift up the heavy rail line, which had never been done.
Question here.
Hi, my name's Elizabeth. Thanks for your presentation this afternoon. As a long time Sydney resident, I've seen nothing, a small business owner, I've seen nothing but growth and prosperity, and I'm personally very, very satisfied with everything the government's doing. But I noticed your presentation tonight was an effort, and it warms my communication's heart. Your conversation tonight was peppered with, we need to communicate better. It's all about the how, it's all about the why, it's all about the narrative. And obviously you have a background in that area. But what I wonder when I'm hearing politicians communicate, call it, and to their detriment, why aren't they communicating better? Nobody is a born communicator. All executives are trained in processes, you know, you learn how to get out of difficult situations. You know all this from your background. I'm just wondering, why aren't they honing those communication skills?
Okay. So the suggestion is you're a great communicator, but not everyone is. So what should be done in order that politicians can communicate more effectively?
Well, first of all, people don't necessarily need to agree with you. They respect you if you have your view and you can stand by your principles and explain it. The observation I'd make about communication now versus politicians in the past is that it's such an incredible pace of change in terms of the communication. So recently, this time last year, in fact, we had 400,000 bats to send on Batemans Bay. Lovely grey-headed flying fox. They had the time of their lives. Completely destroyed the community in the process. But courtesy of the Facebook generation, I was able to communicate directly with 800 local residents who'd formed their own little Facebook group. And it was an effective way to explain to them quite literally what was happening every half day in terms of how we were managing that issue. And that's the type of thinking which needs to go into the political process in terms of, well, how do you reach as many people as quickly as possible? I just see the impact of Facebook in this regard, more so than Twitter, as being something which we've got to invest more so in and be very much. Well, they're doing it to their own detriment.
Yeah,
it's an own goal. It's an own goal. That's right.
Yeah. Question here, and then we go down the back up there. Yeah.
Louise, I'm very interested in what you're saying, and inspired by your enthusiasm and things that are really good things that you can see, tangible things. And I'm also inspired by what's happening out at Badgers Creek, because I see that it's a change in the world, that we have an opportunity there to do some amazing things to help the Cinderella of Sydney that's been ignored and social infrastructure for so many years. I'm also excited about your view of opening up and unlocking routes, and I've read recently that there's talk about making Badgers Creek a regional airport so it can be open to any airline and not be under this constraint of just a few, you know, minor, powerful, or fewer airlines or the powerful ones, but also the importance of providing infrastructure within that area.
Could you speak up, please?
Yes, sorry.
We've got to get to the end of this anyway. Yes,
the importance of infrastructure in and around Badgers Creek from Sydney, but also within that area, things like rail, light rail, roadways, etc. So
there's a question essentially focused on the developments of Badgers Creek and the positive impact on that part of Sydney.
Yeah, I mean, look, it will be a third city out there. I mean, at its core will be an airport which, for argument's sake, I think once the airlines work out exactly what they want to do with it, it's hard to work out. I think it has enormous and incredible freight potential. Stephen Byron, who runs Canberra Airport at the moment, is taking a lot of interest from Western Sydney in terms of getting freight out through Canberra at the moment. And then, obviously, once Badgerys Creek opens up, all of those connections around freight are going to be very important. And, of course, the employment land opportunities that exist in and around the airport too will drive enormous change. We've got to get the rail strategy right. I know there's a lot of talk about rail around the airport, but the rail investment is going to be much more significant than the airport investment itself, which is why it's going to take some time to work out the best solution. Actually, I'm more interested in how you might connect the people of Western Sydney to the airport as opposed to the people of here in town, because the reality is it will be an airport for the people of Western Sydney. So therefore the question becomes, well, how do you link in the people of Blacktown and Penrith and Liverpool and Campbelltown, Parramatta, into the facility? So, we're looking very closely at that with the Commonwealth. There's obviously not going to be a determination made anytime soon. I know there's a desire out of Canberra to have rail open the day the airport opens, which is idealistic, but we're also hearing sort of crazy ideas about spending $30 billion of of money between high-speed rail here and there and everywhere else. We've got to get the strategy right. And, of course, on top of that is the challenges around corridor protection as well. So we're doing a lot of work in that sense to try and get it right. My sense out of it, particularly with the advent of autonomous vehicles, is the whole notion and concept of transport is going to change dramatically. In fact, tomorrow, the Roads Minister and I are going to sit in an autonomous vehicle together, and these will become mainstream very quickly. Now, that changes everything in terms of road capacity. I think it'll make transport planners think, well, do we really need to build a 10-lane freeway when, you know, the whole notion and concept of road capacity is going to change dramatically? And that's where I think, certainly in and around that airport precinct, we've got that opportunity to make sure our investments are smart.
Okay, so there's a question down the back and then over here and here. We've got to be very quick, okay? Jay, all right? Now, hang on, we're going here and then you're not. Okay, up there, yep.
Can you enlighten us on the North Highway, the Pacific Highway between Sydney and, say, Coffs Harbour?
Question about the Pacific Highway between Sydney and...
Road and an end date on
duplication to be completed by 2019.
So Sydney and what, Byron Bay?
Yeah, and large investments from Canberra, enormous amount of roadworks going on at this point in time. We're also investing significant dollars in places like Coffs Harbour to do bypasses and try and obviously improve the traffic flow up and down the route. But, you know, an incredible number of lives have been lost on that road over such a, you know, so many generations. So it's great to get that duplication program well and truly underway.
Okay, so there's the question there. Fred.
Minister, thank you for saying that we're going to get trains every 4 minutes on the North West Rail. Are you committing to trains every 4 minutes on the rest of T1? Because at the moment, with the huge infilling of housing, particularly all along the highway going north and around all the stations, the population that's using the trains is vastly increased from what it was 4 years ago and whenever you created the timetable.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a question about the frequency of trains on T1, and my own personal question is, what's T1?
So, Jared, go down to Central and catch the T1 out to Penrith, or T1
just
as it links
line.
Round Northern, so it links round. It's a great question. Western Sydney's main train line into town, come 2031, given the growth, means that we can't physically get people onto trains. So we've got to build another metro, and it's called Metro West. We announced industry engagement, the former Premier and I did back in December, to talk about how we will develop a train between Parramatta and the CBD, which doubles the rail capacity between the two centres, but delivers us a fully automated train, such as the metro we're building currently, which can service precincts, but also look at ways in which we can deliver an express service, similar to the style of train that exists in Hong Kong from the airport into the centre of town. So we are exploring that. Value capture will play its part in terms of that development, but we want to develop a train which will link the Bays precinct, the Sydney Olympic Park precinct, and of course Parramatta and the CBD. And then at the same time, free up the capacity on the existing heavy rail in from Western Sydney. And, of course, that then links round to the northern part of the city. And it's major investment. There is no ifs or buts. It's got to happen.
OK, there's a question there and there's a question here. Yep. Have a question.
The next
Yep.
There has been a persistent claim by opponents that capacity of the trams will not be sufficient to replace the bus routes it's supposed to be replacing. Is there a capacity problem, and if so, what's the mitigation strategy?
Is there a capacity problem concerning trams in the eastern suburbs?
Look, we're going to develop the bus network over the next 12 months to integrate into the light rail investment as well. If you consider one tram moves 9 buses off Sydney streets, it's an absolutely worthwhile investment. But it does mean that we've got to have an integration in terms of transport modes which work, and we're still working through that bus network in and around that. Can I say more broadly, in terms of the light rail project, it is an enormous challenge. I'm very grateful to those who are suffering the most during the construction phase, the difficulties and the challenges, particularly from business perspective, that are being disrupted as a result. But it is going to transform George Street in an incredible way, particularly once we see that pedestrian zone put down. And, you know, we are going to obviously see the extension of the service out to Randwick, out to Kensington, with the obvious benefits to the university, the hospital, and, of course, also Moore Park as well. So we're going to see the reduction in vehicle movements down George Street from 1,000 per hour to 30 as a result of this investment. And that will lead to an enormous change in the way in which people think about the city, there's no doubt. But again, it's a lot of homework happening behind the scenes in relation to how you achieve that integration with the bus network at the moment.
Go be quick, yep.
Andrew, I think most people would think you're doing an outstanding job in infrastructure. And what you said earlier, though, indicated that underneath all this, there is a leakage of support for the Conservative government going out to, 700,000 people, I think, at the last election. So is the inner structure, which I'm interested in. Is the government aware that the punters, whatever you want, pub test people, whatever you call them, are feeling like, although the trains and the buses are going to get better, the personal relationships that people have with government and understanding where you're taking is, do you guys understand that needs to be improved a lot because people don't trust me?
People are sick of having their rights trampled all over. I can say that particularly from a country member's perspective. The intrusion on property rights. If politicians, make the decisions that we saw with the greyhound industry and get it wrong, you can forget the infrastructure that you're building around someone. So we've got to be very sensitive to that. People don't like being told how to live their lives. That said, government has a responsibility to provide the safety nets and the community safety that we do, and we've got to get that balance right. Sometimes we haven't. So we learned a lot out of that greyhound decision internally. Yes, there was absolutely horrible things happening in that industry, and it has to be cleaned up. There's no ifs or buts. But it did have an effect where people felt that their rights were being intruded on. So we've got to be very careful of that.
Question here.
Just with regards to housing affordability, obviously it's the rage and the big topic of the day. But the elephant in the room is taxes, land tax and stamp duty, which aren't being discussed. But in the context that stamp duty prohibits, obviously, transactions to an extent, and land tax effectively ensures rents need to rise in order to keep up with the growth in the tax, what's the government doing to move away from these taxes at a future point, because it seems it's becoming more reliant on them rather than less?
Look, stamp duties make up roughly around 10% of the incoming revenue, right? So it's a substantial revenue source for state government. The reality is we do not have the capacity to do substantial tax reform on our own because of our dependency on revenue from Canberra. Which brings me to my point tonight. Be brave and get on with some proper reform. We've got inefficient state taxes all across the board, and they need to be looked at in the context of national reform. There's no other way to do it. I've been the state's treasurer and I've seen it. So, we've got to work through those challenges, and we've just embarked on some tax reform just in the last week or so. We've been very public about the changes we're making in terms of the fire services, emergency services levy, which originally was a levy on household contents insurance, and we're now moving that to council rates so that everybody across the entire community, broader base, makes a contribution to when a fire truck turns up at their house if it's on fire. So they're the types of changes we are making, but that's within the capacity and the constraints that we've got given those revenue constraints. So to my way of thinking, if you're going to reform those taxes, you've got to have national reform.
We've got 4 minutes left, so we've got to be very quick. There's a question there and a question there. Only two of them, one here and one there. Yep, go. Yep. Got to be quick.
Minister, you know that the rubber will hit the road in terms of your comment about local in the North Shore by-election. Have you any sympathy for the people in Blues Point Road, and only two broken, who will see dump trucks go up there maybe for many years? And secondly, I believe at this point in time you're doing a shocking job in selling the B line to the Northern District, which to me is sensational, and yet virtually no news from the government.
Okay, there's a question about Blues Point Road and trucks and the B line, wherever the B line is.
Thank you for your Dorothy Dixer. I'm now going to explain to everybody those two vital projects. First of all, the B line, for everyone's benefit, is a bus rapid transit solution to the northern beaches. We're going to be putting in double deck buses. We are looking to improve the reliability of the service. We're looking to improve particularly the service delivery after 7 o'clock at night and get a better bus service to those residents who've suffered for too long. We also, of course, have seen some discussion around a new motorway project, that part of town, and I'm not letting out any secrets in terms of this, but we have been looking at doing some homework internally. In terms of your Blues Point Road problem, for everyone's benefit, I think what you mean is the fact that I've got to build a tunnel under the harbour with the Metro project, and unfortunately, because of the very nature of the tunnel boring under the harbour, we have to use a different type of tunnel boring machine to the ones which are being used currently out on, or we've seen out in operation on the northwest, and we will use for the 30 kilometres between Chatswood and Sydenham. We have to use a specialised machine, which means that we're able to tunnel under the waterlogged sandstone under the harbour, but then we've got to pull it out somewhere. And unfortunately, it's in that McMahon's Point area. So our aim, and I've said it to them repeatedly, try and restrict it as much as you can in terms of the interference. And of course, as always, we're happy to look at how we might remove the sediment. And there is some other options potentially around barges, which, you
yes,
know,
what about barges?
That's something which can be looked at. And I've asked the project team to do that. I'm not a fan of construction disruption, don't get me wrong. I hate it more than anybody else in this room. But unfortunately, it's a necessary evil given the challenges with tunnel boring under the harbour.
Very quickly up the end there, go be very quick.
Yeah, the Military Road Spit Bridge congestion has been going on for years and years and years. And various proposals put up and disappear. Where are you at with the tunnel?
As I just said, you know, we've been doing some homework. I'm not going to say any more in this regard, but I know anyone who's been in Gillian Skinner's electorate has received a newsletter recently. Just be aware that we're very conscious of the challenges besetting that part of Sydney. We also have a major, obviously in terms of that part of Sydney, we've major investment, particularly in terms of a hospital development, Northern Beaches Hospital. So we're also very mindful of the road constraints that exist in and around that facility, and of course the challenges besetting that part. It's one of the worst roads in Australia, congestion-wise. Again, it's something which I know the people of the Northern Beaches sometimes feel like those from country New South Wales in that sense, a little bit left behind.
Minister, thanks. Thanks very much. I've learned a lot tonight, and we do have a lot of people watching on Sky News on channel 648, so I just wanted to everyone know what the T1 and the B something or other is. Just in conclusion, without question, the infrastructure development in New South Wales has been quite astonishing, particularly since for so many decades we didn't have much. Or for a couple of decades leading into the current government, we didn't have much, and now we have a lot. And what's been important about all this, this has been able to go ahead with a budget that, as I understand it, is still in surplus. So Andrew Constance, with a background in as Finance Minister, as Treasurer, and now as Infrastructure and Transport Minister, has obviously played a hugely important role in the contemporary economic success of Australia's largest state. So it was great to have the Minister here again tonight. I'm sure he'll come back in the future, but for tonight, thank you and well done, and keep up the good work.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.